Thanks for downloading the Overdrive podcast. If you're ever looking to get behind the scenes, it's simple. Follow us on Instagram at TSN1050, or you will see myself, O-Dog and Noodles, what we do in the studio, before the show, during the show, after the show, constantly updating stories and best of clips. Again, follow us on Instagram at TSN1050. So we had Ross Atkins, the GM of the Jays, on about a half an hour ago and tried to get to the bottom of the John Gibbons stuff. Like, yeah. Everyone's talking about it. That's,
oh, yeah.
It's the story in the city. What is going on with John Gibbons? Is he going to manage the team the rest of the year? Is he going to be here next year? Is he getting through the week? Like, it's the only thing people care about. Only thing people talk about. And Ross is a smart guy. He knows he's coming on this show. He knows what we're going to be talking about.
Yes. And he didn't give us much of an answer. He did not shut down the rumors. I mean, you and I were both sitting here going, he must be doing his rounds today to shut down these rumors, to shut down the swirl of speculation that John Gibbons is not long for the seat as the Blue Jays manager, but he did nothing of the sort. He did not shut it down. In fact, he only fanned the flames.
Yeah, that's what I was expecting. I think you were expecting the same thing. I thought he was going to come on guns a-blazing saying, I don't know where all this kind of stuff started. Gibbons isn't going anywhere. And it doesn't mean it's a lock that he's getting fired tonight or by the end of the week, but if he was committed to Gibbons being here the rest of the season, he would have come on and said that. There's no reason not to say it.
Exactly.
And we began the interview by asking Ross Atkins, who joined us about a half an hour ago, give us an update on the status of John Gibbons.
Oh, he's, you know, Gibby and I every day enjoy talking about just how we can get better and, you know, really have established a great deal of respect for him and have a great relationship and everything. All of our discussions are about our daily improvement, how to put the best foot forward for each game. And, you know, as you know, we also now talk a lot more about our future, and he is very much a part of those discussions as we think about how we can improve the organization.
So Atkins, Shapiro, Gibbons talking all the time about the future and how they can improve, but didn't answer in terms of his status with the team the rest of the year. So, natural follow-up here. Big-time journalism going
on
this
great.
Show. Big-time
You're
journalism.
You're doing great.
This is what you would expect out of someone from the Star, I would think. Had to follow up and be like, all right, so, like, is he coming? Is he a lock to be here the rest of the year? What's the answer on that? So, he's 100% the manager the rest of the season?
Yeah, again, like, listen, I don't know the best way to categorize these discussions. It really is. It's the best thing I can tell you is he is he's a pleasure to work with, and he is absolutely a part of all of our discussions that involve the future.
Okay, so another kind of dodge to an extent, and then the second follow-up or third question in this line of questioning?
Another natural follow-up, because the answer he just gave you there did not address anything.
Is that all you can tell us, is that you're just having conversations but no commitment long-term?
Yeah, our commitment's to improvement and getting better every day. That goes for every employee here. So I absolutely respect and understand your interest and your inquiry, but our focus is on how we get better each day.
So take that for what it's worth. I mean, people are going to take it and run with it, clearly, but I got to be honest, I was surprised by that line of answering, because again, if Gibbons is here for the rest of the year, you come on the show and you douse the fire with water.
Yeah.
And you just say, stop asking me. He's not going anywhere.
Exactly.
At the end of the year, we'll revisit, of course. The end of the year, you do your evaluation, you figure out what's going to happen, and I think people were prepared for Gibbons to be done at the end of the year anyway. Sure sounds like Gibbons is probably prepared for that move as well. But when you don't definitively say on this type of a radio show that, yeah, he's a lock to be here the rest of the year, how are you expecting people to receive
right.
that?
Especially at a moment where there have been reports that he will be relieved of his duties in short order, perhaps before this weekend series with the Tampa Bay Rays is out. So, yeah, and then my immediate takeaway from that is those reports likely have some grains of truth in them. And he talked about it. I loved his one answer where he talked about how, I don't know the best way to categorize these discussions. Well, these discussions being, are they in discussions with John Gibbons about his future? And that's what it sounds like. There's been reports to that effect, which is, could they come to an agreement where, you know, John Gibbons has 1 year remaining on his deal. They could have an amicable split of some sort where they spin it as John Gibbons leaving on John Gibbons' own accord, or some such. Maybe those, I mean, again, speculation here, but there's been plenty of reports by, you know, credible baseball insiders that these things are going on. And certainly that set off your radar that that's indeed what he was referring to.
Right. So we'll see. I mean, Gibbons has already spoken with the media. John Gibbons is not going to say anything on the record about Atkins, about Shapiro, about his security.
No.
It doesn't make sense for him to do that because he's got a year left on the deal and he's going to want to collect that money. And he's not going to do that publicly. He's not going to go on the record and say anything. He's probably not going to react to comments from Ross.
No.
You know, I would like to believe someone will ask him at some point, like, hey, what do you think about this? But I'd love to do it, but he won't come on the show. And I don't think he's really going to be comfortable talking about anything but actually what's happening on the diamond over the next month and a half because he understands the position he's in and the position the team's in right now.
Yeah. And I guess, hey, you know, the grand tradition of GM manager relationships. I mean, I guess if you would have come on here and given him the unequivocal endorsement, which could have been a load of you know what, that could be the kiss of death too, right? Sometimes the endorsement comes right before the firing. You know, the history has told us that, right? So this non-committal hemming and hawing about, hey, we're all trying to get better and we have great discussions and a great relationship. I mean, you know, my gut feeling is, yeah, it doesn't sound like Gibbons is going to be around for long, but it's hard to know when you got a corporate speaker like Ross Atkins sort of giving you all the corporate speak.
Yeah, no, listen, I'm not bracing myself for him to be fired tonight or even by the end of the week necessarily, but prior to the interview, I didn't think it made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And that's the difference here with this context in terms of where the team is at. Generally, that vote of confidence that eventually turns into actually you're fired is when there's a good team in contention that is falling apart.
True.
That is not the case here.
No.
This team's 27 games out, or 28 games out, whatever it is. They're not making the playoffs. They have been out of it for 2 months.
Yes.
So what would have possibly changed that all of a sudden you think on August 8th or whatever, John Gibbons has got to go?
Well,
like that's the, it's, again, if your team is in a playoff spot and then you lose 10 or 12 in a row and you think you're losing the clubhouse, I get it.
Yeah, then you're in crisis mode.
Crisis mode. Maybe the guy's got to go. You don't like what he's bringing to the table, or he's letting something slide that shouldn't be let slide. What has happened, or what possibly could have been accumulating in the background that would lead the Blue Jays front office to make the case that, okay, Gibbons, it doesn't make sense to keep him until the end of the year?
Well, I guess the only thing you can, my best speculation would be, you got the September call-up season coming. You got this farm system that's rated number 3 in all of Major League Baseball by Baseball America. You've got the guys that you're going to consider core pieces, or you certainly hope to consider core pieces going forward, are going to get their first exposure to the big leagues. And I guess if you're all about culture, like every, you know, sports executive is about culture these days, and if you're all about setting a tone for really a new generation, a whole fresh start, a turning of the page for this organization, Maybe you want to set the tone with the manager of your choice, because we know John Gibbons was not the choice of Ross Atkins or Mark Shapiro. He was the choice of Alex Anthopoulos. And that, to me, would be the best explanation of any of why they'd make a move at this point in mid-August in a season that's otherwise lost.
We'll revisit this throughout the afternoon. Steve Simmons will join us just after 6. He wrote a piece in The Sun this morning about Gibbons and how he should be handled down the road, and we'll see. I mean, Gibbons is a guy who he spent 2 stints here in Toronto and long tenures throughout those stints. He's had success outside of Cito. I mean, he's had a lot of success.
He has.
And in this century, there's no one that comes close.
No.
Gibbons.
No, there's not. And the other thing is, like, he's got a lot of goodwill.
Yeah, you know, he does.
And that's hard in this market. When you look at people that work for this organization, he's on a short list.
So we'll get back into this a little bit later in the afternoon. Joining us now on the Maple Toyota Hotline is our good buddy Alex Marvez from the Sporting News and Sirius XM NFL Radio. What's happening, Alex?
Hey, it's Dave. Doing great. About to head to Broncos training camp, or just a Falcons training camp a little bit earlier today. Continuing my tour across America. Boy, oh boy, that Falcons team, they are a dangerous bunch, especially if they can stay healthy. It was actually, it's weird to forget about this. They were actually the only team in the NFC to repeat as a playoff team from 2016. Everyone else was new in the field last year except for them, and to think about, you know, being 5-5 after 10 games and the Super Bowl hangover. You know, they could never really truly get going as a team, but I do think they'll be better on offense in 2018. I also think, too, the defense now is really morphing into what it is that Dan Quinn wanted when he took over. I mean, this is a formidable group that finished in the top 10 in both fewest yards allowed and scoring. So I think there's a pretty darn good group from what I've seen out there today.
Well, that's an interesting point that you touch on there when we're making our predictions, because it's always the obvious move is to look back on the standings last year and just say, okay, those teams are going back, and it never happens. We get burned every single year when we're trying to predict what's going to happen. It's never predictable. And we were talking about that with the NFC East yesterday. Like, the Eagles deserve to be the number one seed, or the expectation is that they'll repeat. But who's to say that the Giants won't get drastically better? Who's to say that with Alex Smith in Washington, all of a sudden they won't turn it up? And, you know, the Cowboys, we goof on them all the time, but they have won a lot of games over the past couple of years.
Right, and you're right about that division. It is a little bit tricky, and I think the Giants are set for a big-time rebound. I just love the culture Pat Shermer is building there, and Dave Gettleman. You haven't really heard any issues with Odell Beckham Jr., and it seems like they are willing to make him at some point the highest paid receiver in NFL history. They're having active talks with his agent about that. I would imagine something gets done sooner than later in that regard. I mean, because Odell knows what it's like. You suffer another major injury, and all of a sudden, you know, tens of millions of dollars may be vanishing from your pocket. So I think that's something to consider there as well. You're right with Alex Smith. Listen, there's some folks who think this Redskins offense may actually be better with Alex Smith at quarterback than Kirk Cousins. And it was weird because Alex was actually the best deep passer in the NFL last year. I'm not joking when I say this. I mean, of course, he waited 13 seasons to showcase this skill. I guess he just figured, why not pull it out now while he was going to be on the trade block this offseason. He really had a nice year last year for the Kansas City Chiefs. You know, and then you throw in the Cowboys. And look, there's talent on that Cowboys team. Obviously, the offensive side of the football with Dak, with Zeke, et cetera. You know, how good can they be? I just feel like the Cowboys are still a 500 caliber franchise, but nonetheless, this is another team that could really push the Eagles. I mean, that's the thing. Sure, the Eagles go into this, you know, with that huge target on their back. That's the thing that's so different than last year and all the good vibes about Philadelphia. Everyone is gunning for them this season because they want to knock off the best team in football. It's always a measuring stick. Even for the bad teams, and just for more motivation. Oh, if you beat the defending Super Bowl champion, it says that your program is headed in the right direction. So I'm really excited about it. I'm excited to see, too, what's going to happen to quarterback. Is Carson Wentz going to be back? Is he fully good to go? Because it does appear that he may have taken a slight step back in his rehab by being benched in practice earlier this week.
So, Alex, if football season is about a month away, that means Hard Knocks season is upon us. And I really got to get your take on this. What would have possessed the Cleveland Browns, a franchise that's widely, you know, considered one of the worst in all of pro sports and has won one game in the past two seasons combined, what would have possessed them to put themselves under the microscope that is a reality TV show that captures a lot of stuff about the flaws within your organization?
Well, I mean, it captures flaws, but it also captures hope, right? And I think that's what the Cleveland Browns were looking to do. And I think, you know, having those cameras there brings responsibility. You don't want to be that guy. You don't want to be Chad Ochocinco getting arrested on a domestic violence charge and being cut on HBO. You don't want to be that guy.
Yeah.
So I think players realize that, and it does lead to a little bit more of an intense training camp. To be honest, I've been around Hard Knocks so much that the players barely notice the cameras. They're trying to promote that it's a new time, a new era in Cleveland. And what better way to do that than to provide unfettered access? Now, look, you know, some players are going to be embarrassed. You're going to see coming up with Antonio Callaway, the Browns wide receiver, had drug issues at the University of Florida. It's popped once again on a marijuana possession charge. He says that the weed in the car wasn't his. It was a car that he shipped up from Florida, and his buddies were using it. Of course, now it's been shown, the police report shows that there was a piece of ammunition inside there, maybe some bullets, I mean, things like this. It's just, you know, again, I think that's something that's embarrassing for a franchise. But I think that they realize, look, what better way to try to promote ourselves and show that we're going in the right direction than do it on Hard Knocks and try to generate some excitement from a franchise that really hasn't had any in just so long. I mean, they've won one game in 32 years. I really believe it's harder to go 0-16 than 16-0. And somehow the Browns were able to do it. It's remarkable. I mean, perfection. They haven't won a football game since Christmas Eve of 2016. Let's simmer on that.
Yeah, seriously. So are you buying the pitch that there actually is reason for hope here?
Well, I mean, the roster's better. Now, how much better? I don't know. I think Tyrod Taylor has a really good veteran presence. The one thing Tyrod Taylor may not win a whole heck of a lot of games, but you know what? He doesn't lose a whole heck of a lot either in terms of making big-time mistakes, turnovers, et cetera. And I think that's really what the Browns were looking for. Just have a placeholder quarterback who's going to give them a chance to win some games. And look, they got the Jets in week three. That may be the first Cleveland victory we're looking at. But I think that's the thing. They got to get something on the board early. I think they'll feel a little bit better about themselves. I think they're hoping that Myles Garrett takes the next step in his career, year two of his NFL career. They really feel good about their secondary and the addition Denzel Ward, rather, from Ohio State. Probably Rovey on my mind. Denzel Ward of Ohio State, you know, they passed up an elite pass rushing prospect in Bradley Chubb to bring him in. And they just feel like he's going to really upgrade their secondary. So I think there's a lot of pieces there for the Browns to work. Now, of course, too, you know, Hugh Jackson and the reflection upon him. And, of course, Hard Knocks last night, a lot of look at his personal life, losing his mother. He's lost his sister this year. Been a very tough go from Hugh, but he still has the endorsement of Jimmy Haslam, the Browns owner, who really wants to see things work out for Hugh, with John Dorsey, the GM. And whether it works out, well, we're going to find out about 4 months from now.
Yeah, with Alex Marvez of the Sporting News. I had a different take on this Jarvis Landry rant that was on Hard Knocks last night, and he was in a video room with other wide receivers, and it's laced with profanity. We can't even play it. It's not worth playing because it's just it's all beep, 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 beep. But he's going on about how, you know, everything's going to change now because he's not going to put up with anything. And if you're slightly injured but you can still practice, you got to get out there and practice. And I don't know what happened here in the past. And a lot of people are amplifying that as, wow, what a motivating speech. But I look at that as this guy's just throwing dirt again on the Browns. Like, who the hell is Jarvis Landry to look down on the Browns? I mean, you're coming from Miami. He didn't come from the Patriots. You know, he didn't win 5 Super Bowls in the past 15 years. Like, I thought that was so disrespectful. And it was, quite frankly, I thought it was just manipulated, really. He knew the cameras were on and he wanted to be a big shooter.
And that's the part that I think gets to you, right? And that's the negative of Hard Knocks. And listen, I've talked to editors there. I've talked to guys, you know, coaches who have said, what a headache this is for us. We got to deal with guys that are mugging in front of the camera, and then if their segment isn't on TV, then they get upset and they talk about it, you know, behind the scenes in the meeting room. Why didn't you guys feature me? You know, and listen, trust me, the team edits this stuff before it goes out there. The team is fully aware of everything that is on Hard Knocks. They screen the show before it gets out. So it's not a shock what happened last night with Jarvis Landry for anyone that's seeing it. And listen, I think Jarvis too feels, look, you paid me to be an elite level wide receiver. He is the only wide receiver in NFL history to catch 400 passes during his first 4 seasons. So, you know, to him, he has some skins on the wall. And he, you know, I think there was a little bit of hyperbole obviously involved, a little bit of, you know, showmanship in front of the camera. But I also think too, if you're talking about, like, look, he's played with guys that have been committed to each other in South Florida. I know for a fact that Kenny Stills was battling some pre-offseason injuries back in about 2016, that he kept going because his relationship was so strong with the other wide receivers. He was willing to play through pain and get out there. And look, that's the thing. I think he just wonders, are all these guys really hurt? Are they not able to get through practice? Because remember this, too. Every time a guy misses practice, what does that mean? More reps for Jarvis Landry. So might be a little bit self-serving as well. Get some guys out there. But he's trying to change the culture. I like to try to think of it as a positive. I'm not going to play it up or anything else than it is. It is a reality television show. We don't know how Jarvis is looked at by the rest of his teammates. But, you know, I think the Browns fans, you know, at least as far as the show business element of this goes, would rather see a player like that than some of the stuff that's been going on with the Browns and the disaster at the wide receiver position it's been the past couple of years.
Thanks, Alex. We'll do it again down the road.
Can't wait. Thank you so much.
Here's Alex Marvez of the Sporting News joining us here on the Maple Toyota Hotline. Maple Toyota takes away the fears of buying a pre-owned vehicle by sharing service history, lien history, and accident history. Visit MapleToyota.com. Jarvis Landry has played a playoff game back in the wild card game in 16. He actually put up pretty good numbers.
Yeah.
But again, he's coming from a team that signed Jay Cutler out of desperation a year ago, that had a coach on their staff that was doing cocaine down the hall where this guy was working out. And he walks in as if he's like a seasoned vet that's got all this hardware. I looked at that as, A, it was a production. It was him putting it on.
Of course it was.
But like, everyone knows, everyone around Cleveland and everyone around the Browns knows how bad they've been. And a lot of those guys that were in the room were a part of that. They don't need to hear from you about how awful they were and how big of a joke they've always been. That's how I read it. Like,
Yeah.
Why would you keep kicking dirt on what the Browns are all about?
Like he was basically like he was just trying to make everybody feel bad, you know, to make himself feel good, which is, I guess you would call that bullying, right? In the rest of the world, but in the NFL, it passes as motivational speech stuff. But you know, the other thing is like, you know, this is a league about staying healthy. Like practicing hurt is not a good idea. You know, like there's no reason to practice hurt because the teams that stay healthy, guess what? They do better than the teams that don't stay healthy. And adding to an injury or risking further injury in practice because you already got one tweak just to be a man or to be macho or to, you know, improve the team culture or whatever it is or to please Jarvis Landry, least of all, it doesn't strike me as wise.
No, and I thought Hugh Jackson, actually, there was an interesting clip that came out of the coaching room and the coaches' meeting where there were a couple of coordinators and a couple of coaches that were kind of pushing him on giving guys days off and maybe being a little bit soft on the players. And Todd Haley, who's the offensive coordinator there, was real. You could tell he was flustered. Like,
sure.
Because he's like, who do we think we are to be able to take days off? Like, the old school football mentality is we got to get way tougher. We can't let these guys off the hook. There's a reason you've won one game in 2 years. And it's not all because of talent, it's because it's been a country club, et cetera. Which there might be some truth to that. But I found it interesting that Hugh Jackson put himself out there right afterwards and said, listen, I used to be in your chairs and I thought the same way.
Yeah.
But now I'm in this chair. As the head coach, I got to own it if a guy doesn't even get to the regular season
because exactly.
We're pushing him too hard.
Exactly.
You're not going to take those bullets. I'm going to take those bullets.
Exactly. And talent wins. You need to keep your talent healthy. I mean, the teams that have disastrous seasons, almost to a team, what's the problem? Their best players get hurt. So, yeah, this idea that you just got to soldier on and play through your injuries and practice, I mean, that's old school nonsense thinking. I mean, they're really progressive teams now. Like, they're all about let's enhance recovery. Let's put tons of money into sports science and how do we keep these guys on the field when it matters, not on Wednesday, Thursday. Well, I guess if you're playing Thursday night, but on Sunday.
Yeah, getting through an NFL training camp is a sport.
Yes.
Like, the amount of guys that have already been injured, and there will be a lot more injuries.
Oh, for sure.
They haven't even really played games yet.
Yeah.
They're just starting to play preseason games.
Exactly.
There will be drastic injury reports. There will be big names that are done for the year before we even get to September. So it is a landmine, and you got to find a way to dance around them.
Look at your Packers are a great example of a team that just has had catastrophic injuries over the past handful of years. But they've had this window where Aaron Rodgers has been the best quarterback in the league, and he just hasn't had targets, right? Because of what? Injury.
Well, exactly. And Jake Ryan, who's a linebacker for him, he's done for the year already. And he was supposed to be a big piece for them in that defense that needs help.
Yeah.
And he's already done for the year. And, you know, you mentioned Rodgers, and people have been buzzing about his comments. I believe it was at practice yesterday where he lit up a lot of the wide receivers. And I got no problem with that.
Yeah, but that was a different one. That was like the scout team guys, right? Like the young players who were just in camp for the first time. And he was basically calling out their work ethic.
Right. Yeah. But what's wrong with that?
That's different.
He's the guy. He's the 34-year-old stud quarterback.
That's different. I'm not saying you don't work hard, but I'm saying you don't play through injury before a game. You know, you try and get to the game. You know,
yes.
Like it's the most important thing is being healthy for the game. That doesn't mean you don't work hard in practice. The two aren't mutually exclusive. And I think what Rodgers was saying made sense. What Jarvis Landry was saying was a bunch of showboating nonsense.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. It was him going off trying to pretend like. Well, not even pretend. He knew the cameras were on him.
But
he knew that this would be heavily promoted and that it would make the cut.
Well, it's like Alex Marvez said. These guys are basically competing to make the cut. They know if they want to get on the show, it's got to be good. It's got to be juicy. It's got to be profanity. Profanity has to be prominent, ideally.
And this is your moment if you're on the Browns, because chances are, once they start playing, no one's going to care about you anymore.
Exactly.
So you might as well get your time in the limelight now. We're going to catch up with Claver Ferrer, who was one of the two gentlemen stuck in the elevator last night when it started filling up with water. And it got to a point where they were actually like standing on the, what would you call
the
it?
The handrails,
I guess, around the elevator to make sure that their heads were elevated above the water.
It's
and
amazing.
Just an absolute miracle that they were saved in the end. The cops that got in there and saved them. They had like a foot worth of oxygen. We're going to get him to explain what that was like.
That's going to be great.
I can't imagine that he's even recovered yet.
Oh, Well, it's just amazing. He hasn't had to recover. They didn't have to go to the hospital, apparently. Like, they were relatively unscathed, other than psychologically, I would assume.
That's right.
I mean, the next time they get in an elevator might be quite a way down the line.
But we're going to ask him that. Yeah. I mean, does he live in a building where he takes an elevator? Does he work somewhere where he takes an elevator? What's his viewpoint of elevators? Because I can't imagine it's a good viewpoint or a positive one. So we're going to catch up with him. Steve Simmons on his piece about Gibbons. We'll get back into what Ross Atkins said or didn't say about the security of John Gibbons. He joined us in the 4 p.m. hour. We'll get back into that in the 6 p.m. hour with Dave Feschuk of the Star and Brian Hayes. Overdrive continues, TSN 1050. All right, Steve Simmons of the Sun will join us just after 6 on his piece about Gibbons in the paper today. Get his reaction to what Ross Atkins had to say in the 4 p.m. hour. We had Ross Atkins, the GM of the Jays, join us, and very noncommittal in terms of the security of John Gibbons the rest of the way. You know, we pushed him. We're like, so is he 100% here for the rest of the season or not? And he would not definitively say he's a lock to be here the rest of the year.
The thing he said was basically, our commitment is to improvement in the great tradition of corporate speak. I mean, our commitment is to improvement. When asked a direct question about, is John Gibbons safe as manager? I mean, it's pretty good stuff.
I mean,
but if you're John Gibbons and you're sitting in your office and you happen to be listening to the TSN 1050 pregame tonight, didn't exactly give you warm feelings about your job security.
No, I can't imagine. He probably wasn't listening, but you never know.
You never know.
Why wouldn't he be listening? I don't see why he would not be listening to us this afternoon.
If indeed he is unaware of his future, maybe, you know, it's possible that they're well aware of what's going on.
Yeah.
He's well aware.
You would think so.
Atkins and Shapiro have had discussions with him about the way they feel about the situation. You would think, and I think one thing that came out of it, it was Atkins really did point to the fact that they're having these discussions about what's possible.
What's going on. Exactly. And he's not going to give us details. I don't expect him to actually open up the curtain and tell us exactly what happens or what's been going on. But
if there was no plans
of more.
But the bottom line is, if there were no plans, or at least if they weren't even thinking about firing John Gibbons, he would have gone a completely different direction.
Absolutely. Yeah. At the very least, he opened the door to the idea that he could be fired at any point.
Exactly.
And then you can't look back on the interview and say, well, wait a minute, you said... So that's how I took it. I think that's how you took it. We'll get back into that later this afternoon. Flash flooding downtown was crazy last night. The Rogers Center had some leaks. Scotiabank Arena.
My basement.
Your basement. You're going to probably pay for that in the future, I would think.
Literally, and
figuratively.
Yes, I've already paid in many ways.
Yes, and one of the scariest scenes ever, man. I read this morning in the Canadian Press. A couple of guys around Jane and St. Clair got stuck in an elevator that started flooding. And this has got to be one of the top 3 or 5 scary moments in human history. I mean, again, I equated this to being on a plane that all of a sudden starts to go down, being dropped in the ocean and there's sharks around, being in the woods and like a grizzly bear comes out of nowhere. You'd just be terrified.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you're in an elevator that is stuck and it's filling up with water. And two guys had to deal with that experience last night. And we have one of them on the line right now. Here is Claver Fryer of Toronto. You gotta take us through this. I mean, now that we're a day removed, how are you feeling today as you look back and think back on that experience last night, Claver?
Well, first, thank you for having me on the show.
Absolutely.
I guess I haven't really had a chance yet to properly process it. I'm telling the story, but it kind of feels like I'm telling it in the third person. Maybe that's some sort of weird defense mechanism.
Yeah, man, I can imagine. Well, let's go through the story, okay? So when it started flooding, why were you in the elevator? Was it your house? Was it your work? I mean, paint the picture for us of what you guys were doing in the elevator.
Well, Gabriel and I, we run a startup company called DreamKey, and we're working late. We actually design camera drones in Toronto. We manufacture here as well, and we're typically working late because this is our business. And we got a knock on the door from the maintenance staff saying that there was a bit of flooding in the basement and that we should move our cars because they could probably get damaged. So I heard that, went downstairs, got onto the elevator, and Gabriel actually had no reason to come down with me. I'm still not sure exactly why he came with me because his car was not parked there. And we got to the basement floor, and I think that we were in the middle of laughing about something that is probably completely not important anymore. And the water started gushing in from the bottom of the elevator as if there was like a fire hose underneath it. Like it was like a scene out of a movie.
So was the power out? Was it pitch black in there? I mean, what was it like once the water started coming in?
No, not yet. And it wasn't, the power hadn't gone out yet, but the situation was that we're in a bit of disbelief. Like we saw the water coming in, but at no point in time did we thought it was like a typical basement flood. Like maybe it was going to be a foot of water at most. And we didn't believe that neither of us really thought that our lives were in danger at that first moment. But the water very quickly started rising, we realized that we have to use the emergency services. Try to use the emergency line. But the water was rising so quickly, but by the time we pressed the emergency telephone button and we got connected, the speaker got submerged. And at that point, we started beginning to panic and realize that our lives were in danger. We didn't know if the water was going to stop rising. And we just started to try to find a cell signal, and we couldn't get a cell signal anywhere. It feels like we were trying forever, like in every spot. By this point, the water was at our waistline or a bit higher, and we could not have connected with anybody. I remember somewhere along there, Gabriel was praying, and I heard him say my name in his prayers. I think asking to keep us safe. And I remember looking around at everything that was going on in this brown, weird, mucky water that was filling up, gushing into the elevator, and thinking about some decisions I could have made that would have put me in a completely different place that day. And I let that be my moment of panic and regret. And then I just remember thinking that I'm not going to let myself die in brown, mucky water stuck in an elevator.
Incredible. Incredible. We're chatting with Claver Fryer from Toronto, who has a business in kind of the northwest end of the city, and ended up stuck in an elevator last night that started flooding. And as he just detailed, it started flooding really, really quickly.
So, Claver, I mean, so you go from, you know, pushing the emergency call button to the speaker being submerged, and then you're not getting a cell signal, and then you're hearing your good friend and business partner praying. How long has this taken place? Like, how fast did that all happen?
It was less than 5 minutes.
Wow.
Less than 5 minutes. The water was coming in very fast. I mean, thankfully, it started to slow down, and I don't know what slowed it down, because the water was actually much higher outside of the elevator than inside. But it started climbing up about one elevator button per minute.
Wow. You're counting the elevator buttons.
Yeah.
Because I had no other, we're in a kind of a panic state, and I couldn't tell if the water was actually rising. So then I started using the elevator buttons to, you know, how much of urgency do we have to put in trying to get out of here? How much time are we going to spend trying to look for an escape hatch or something like that?
So were you screaming for help at any point? I mean, how did you react once you knew you were really, really in trouble?
This was 10:30, 11 at night, so we knew that only like the maintenance staff was in the building, and so we started pounding on the walls and trying to find a hatch, some sort of instructions somewhere, but there was nothing. And we were pounding and screaming, and we didn't hear any responses. So at that point, I knew that we're not going to get cell signal. The water was coming in, and I knew that the water is going to start, you know, making the cell signal worse in as it starts filling up. And so our only chance is to pound a hole in the top, in the ceiling of the elevator, where we found a panel that was unfortunately locked from the outside. And so we're not able to use that hatch to get out.
So how did you end up getting, you know, above water so that you could find cell reception? How did that play out?
I think between Gabriel and I, somehow we coordinated, and Gabriel was pounding at that ceiling hatch, like literally punching it with his fist until his hand started bleeding. And he was able to get it open maybe, I don't know, a couple of centimeters. And I was at the same time holding myself up on the banisters with one hand on the opposite wall and trying to put the phone in different spots to see if we could get some cell signal through the hatch that Gabriel was trying to open. Eventually, I was able to get it open enough that we got some spotty signal. We lost connection with emergency services two or three times after just, you know, barely just getting them on the line. And the water was still continuing to rise up. So eventually, Gabriel thought to use a a journal, a notebook that I keep for work that I had with me, some thick leather binding one, and I use that to pry open the hatch and keep it open wider. Then we finally got a stable signal, and we were able to talk to emergency services. And Gabriel says that we were on the phone with them for about 6 minutes, but that's just that I had no concept of time.
He was on the phone with 911.
No, I was on the phone with 911. He was trying to keep the hatch open. Just Gabriel was keeping track of the time, and he says that was about 6 minutes from when we got them on the line to when we were able to get out.
Wow. So when you finally got someone on the line, what were you trying to express to them? How did you get it across to them that you were kind of living in a movie moment and this was life or death? I mean, how did you catch your breath enough to even express what needed to happen?
Honestly, I was concerned that they weren't going to believe that we were actually in as much of an emergency as we were. I thought that they might think we're just a couple of guys stuck in an elevator panicking and there's, you know, maybe a bit of water coming in. I didn't realize that there was flooding like this going on all around the city because obviously we're stuck in there. And so we're telling them that the water is gushing in, continuing to rise. At this point, it's above our chest levels, like climbing towards our necks, and we're already at standing on the banisters with our heads on the ceiling. And we were thankful to get a hold of them, but we had no idea if they could possibly get anybody over in time to get us out of there before we ran out of breathing space.
So you're sitting there, or you're gasping for breath. You got about a foot more room or headroom before the water is totally enveloping you, and then you're waiting. How long were you waiting after this call?
I think it was maybe apparently it was about 5 minutes or so after that. But I mean, we had it was like minor success after minor success in trying to do something that kind of kept us going. Like first we were able to get the hatch open, we were able to get one bar of reception, and then we missed getting emergency services three times, and then finally we got them on the fourth time and stable. And then until the police officers, they literally had to swim out into the parking garage, prying open a door to try to get to us. Because I don't think the fire department was going to be able to get to us on time.
So did you have to swim out? I mean, what happened when they opened up the doors? How did you go from the elevator to safety? How did you get through that process?
We're in the elevator and we finally heard somebody on the other side. And I think that was the, because they didn't even know where we were. They weren't sure which elevator shaft we were in. And we're just trying to make as much noise as we could so that they could find us. In the commotion, and then they we heard them, and they were trying to give them instruction on which way the door opens because they weren't sure which way to try to pry it open. They didn't have the right tools, so they had to improvise with a crowbar that I think they found somewhere, because there were police officers. They're not the fire department with tools maybe to do this or whatever, right? But if they had not jumped into that water, and they were treading in the water, they couldn't even put their feet down on the ground to open up the door and pry it open with a crowbar. But finally they were able to do it, and water level was higher outside than inside, so some water gushed in, and then we're able to swim out.
Wow. Are you a good swimmer?
I used to think so, but I think in that moment after being in survival mode and a bunch of adrenaline going through, when I knew that we were finally going to be safe, it's like I couldn't swim, and the police officer just had to like drag me a few feet until I got my bearings and started treading water on my own.
With Claver Fryer, who was, again, stuck, stranded in an elevator that lost power. He couldn't get out and started filling up with rainwater last night to the point where they were really... at death's door. I don't think that's hyperbole. It sure sounds that way based on your description of this the situation. So once you finally realize you're alive, you survived, and the cops heroically got to you, were you in shock? Did you feel like you should go to the hospital? It sounds like you guys didn't end up going to the hospital, but at what point did you realize, like, was it kind of a, I can't believe we just went through that, I can't believe I'm alive type of moment?
I'm sure that we both felt that. I don't remember really having words. I just remember feelings, gratefulness. I remember seeing the faces of the people that were the emergency services workers that were waiting on the stairwells or waiting in the lobby. And I think that they were more worried. I don't think that they were sure that they were going to be able to get us out. And they seemed happier to get us out than we were to get out, which to me was shocking, like to see that kind of compassion. And I remember just hugging a bunch of the emergency workers and thanking them, and then trying to see if Gabriel was okay.
Crazy. So when do you go back to work? Did you go back today or what?
So actually, I went back this morning and thinking that I was just going to try to do something monotonous, mechanical, try to just try to do something routine and get back into a normal work mode. Try to deal with the situation, you know, do the boring material stuff, like we're deal with my insurance and the fact that my car was completely submerged. But we had a news crew at the front door.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
So, I mean, are you going to ride that elevator anymore? What are you a stairs guy now? I mean, what's going to happen in the future?
I don't like things like that, taking ownership of myself for you know, people that I care about. So I'm sure that's going to be on my mind, but I'll go back to using everything as normal as soon as everything is safe and fixed. But on that note, like in retrospect, I come from an engineering background, and I think that things need to be made safer, and it's very cheap and easy to make things safer and allow people to survive that kind of situation with, you know, less than $2 worth of equipment in there could have saved our lives very easily and all of this trouble that it's caused.
What would you suggest? Like what's the fix to that situation?
There's not even a 50 cent water sensor in there to detect if there's water. There's not even so that they would open the doors. There's no way to emergency open the doors from the inside of the elevator. The escape hatches or the access hatch is designed so that you can't get out from the inside. So whether it's a fire or there was a flood, there's no way to get out. And there's no mechanism that automatically detects that you need to get out. And so, and the solutions for this stuff is super cheap. Like I work for a company that, I guess, unfortunately for whoever the safety people are that design the stuff, that we understand how to make that stuff. We can make that stuff. And we could outfit these elevators and prevent this from happening to people in the future for, you know, next to nothing compared to the cost of an elevator.
Yeah, we got to get on that, man. Forget Buck of Beer. We need Doug Ford to be listening to you. Like, let's make that happen, 100%. Man. This needs to work in the future because we do not want to be in another situation like the one you were in last night. It's an incredible story. Obviously ecstatic for you and your business partner that you survived. It's really, it was like a James Bond movie. It was a scene out of a James Bond movie, and I'm sure it's one you'll never forget. And I'm not sure the city will either. A lot of people buzzing about it. So we appreciate you coming on and detailing everything from last night, and best of luck with everything going forward.
Thank you very much.
Here's Claver Fryer. What's up? John Tory, Doug Ford, Justin Trudeau. We don't need this with our elevators in this country.
I love that last bit. Like, yeah. That was an interesting little tidbit about how if you had a little water sensor in there that could just, you know, detect, or, you know, a fire sensor, whatever it is, to detect the danger. It's amazing that the escape hatch wasn't worthy of escaping.
Right.
Because it was locked from the outside. I mean, that does strike you as counterintuitive.
What a story, man.
It's an incredible story.
What a story. I mean, that is humanity on display, because I'm sure there are a lot of people that would just pass out, just immediately panic to the point where they'd have a heart attack. Like, and I'm not even making light of it.
Oh, yeah.
You'd be like, I've seen this in many, many movies, and this thing's filling up, and I'm not the Rock, so I can't get out.
Seriously. Like, these guys were incredibly calm, it sounds like. I'm sure they were freaking out inside, but the way they just continue to persevere and calmly keep trying to call 911, even though the call kept getting cut off. And I mean, they did some stuff that, you're right, the average person, a lot of people, would have been way, way too incapacitated to handle.
Well, and credit the police service, too, for the dispatcher for taking it seriously and being like, we got to get on this quickly. And in 6 minutes, the call goes through and they're out.
That's pretty amazing.
And the cops that went down there and put their lives on the line as well, because they had to go into the water. They had to find a way in.
And they didn't have the right tools.
They had to improvise.
I mean that's amazing. Yeah,
the incredible
police officers
story.
That saved them
shout out to them.
Deserve incredible credit, as do the fellows that persevered through it.
Absolutely. Steve Simmons, just after 6 on the security of John Gibbons, or lack thereof. We'll get into the PGA Championship kicking off tomorrow as well. With Dave Festchuk, I'm Brian Hayes. Overdrive continues, TSN 1050.
The greatest moments in history are now up to you. This is TSN 1050's Sound Wars.
Yeah! All right, so time for another Final Four Sound Wars battle representing the Jerry Conference. It's seed number 3.
Mr. Peter Shirelli in Edmonton, I have a poem for you. It goes something like this. Peter, Peter, pumpkin eater, you're not winning the f***ing lottery. And if by some miracle it happens, I'll personally rip that franchise out of Edmonton and ship it off to the worst city on earth. That's right, Winnipeg. You might have a second team starting next season.
All right, so that made it all the way to the Final Four. Number 3 seed in the Jerry Conference, going up against the number 7 seed in the Oh My Goodness Conference.
Ben Smith across the line, takes the 8, 15 into the city, taking care of business. Ben Smith makes it 5-1. On your feet, Rico. On your feet, Toronto. This is the Calder Cup. This is your Calder Cup.
All right, so go to TSN1050.ca, click on Sound Wars, and vote for your favorite Jerry's poem for Peter the Pumpkin Eater Shirelli, or the call of the Marlies winning the Calder Cup. Voting for this Sound War closes tomorrow at 8 a.m. Listen to Landsberg in the morning for the winner and for the start of a second Final Four Sound Wars battle right here on TSN Radio. All right, Steve Simmons coming up in the next hour. We will revisit our conversation with Ross Atkins from the 4 p.m. hour on the security of John Gibbons going forward. I'll get into that and more coming up. Final hour up next. Overdrive continues. TSN 1050.